We're going to move into the TMVR space, so I'd like to introduce Paul Buckman, who's our General Manager of TMVR, and you're up.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Everybody has made it up for lunch. So my name's
Newer members of the LivaNova team, and joined, as Damien mentioned, with the acquisition of Caisson, and I'm now based in Minnesota leading that group, and really excited to be here. After working with Damien and this leadership team for 5 or 6 months, I have to tell you I'm really excited to be part of it. I also want to thank you, like everyone else has, for taking your time to be here. I know you all have busy schedules. And I can imagine, too, that particularly as it relates to TMVR, because it's kind of new and has been, at least for Caisson, a bit stealth up until not that long ago, you're probably anxious to get your arms around what we're about and what we're doing and all that. And I'll do the best I can to bring you up to speed on that. A couple of things I hope you take away from this. One is that I really think we are well positioned to be a leader in this space. And you'll see why as I go through. The other thing, though, is that in addition to the business aspect of this, I'm just really excited to be part of this because this is a meaningful therapy for a lot of people. One of the things I'll talk about is who we're treating. And this is a very sick population of patients who have a really lousy quality of life. I'm guessing all of you know somebody who, or are related to somebody who's in this camp of patients, and it's not a great lifestyle. And the fact that we can now provide something that improves their lives, I think is pretty exciting. And it makes it easy to get people at the facility in Minnesota to come to work every day because it matters. So what I'm going to talk about is our technology a little bit, of course. I'd like to talk a little bit about the market clinical opportunity we're going after. I want to talk about our clinical study plan, which is important, and then a little bit about how we're going to support our customers. And then we'll dive into some Q&A once we have time. Oh. So TMVR, for those of you who don't know, that's transcatheter mitral valve replacement. And basically, it's taking surgical mitral valve replacement and making it percutaneous. At least that's what we're doing. I'll talk a little bit more about it. There are multiple ways to do it. The customer we deal with is primarily the interventional cardiologist. That's who we're shifting this to, and that's who's going to be the main driver of it. But like a lot of structural heart procedures, it's a team effort. And so we're also working with the cardiac surgeon, the anesthesiologist, the echocardiographer, the cath lab staff. It's a team effort in these procedures, particularly early on when everybody's learning it. The disease state that we're treating is primarily mitral regurgitation, and you can't really talk about mitral regurgitation without also talking about heart failure because they go hand in hand. And I think everyone in here knows this is a big population of patients. So the fact that we believe this technology and this procedure has the potential to be 2 to 3 times the size of the TAVR market, which has already gotten quite large, it's not because we all live in Denver. It's because we think that the patient population will drive it, the denominators. So for example, if you just take the U.S. and Europe alone, there are 14 million patients who suffer from mitral regurgitation. Of that 14 million, there's probably 9 million or so that are moderate to severe, which is the primary population that we're targeting. And then of that 9 million, probably 4 million of those people would be very amenable to having this procedure done. But the reality is, because up until just recently, when the MitraClip got approved, the only alternative was either medical therapy or mitral valve surgery. And so only 125,000 people in that market every year are getting treated with mitral valve surgery. So the opportunity to go after that 4 million patients where there's 500,000 being added every year is really significant. And that's just half the world. We still got the other half of the world to go after. So it's suffice it to say, it's a significant opportunity. So mitral valve, why is mitral regurgitation such a problem? The reason is because it's associated with a high rate of mortality if it goes untreated. There's multiple studies you can look at that will confirm that. I've seen studies as high as 57% mortality at 1 year with untreated mitral regurgitation. When people start to get mitral regurgitation and they're in that early stage of heart failure, it's a spiral downwards until they swirl the drain. It's important to treat it as early as possible, but it's really important to treat it and slow it down. If you look at how this is all shaking out today, of course, as I mentioned, you have the surgical population, which has been the way it's been done up until now, and that's broken into two categories. One is surgical repair, and one is surgical replacement. Surgical repair for mitral regurgitation has become the gold standard because the results have been good. The problem is, technically, it's a challenging procedure to do. Not every surgeon is good at it. Not every surgeon wants to do it. There's still a large mitral valve replacement market as well, and that's split between tissue valves and mechanical valves. Valve replacement has its issues too, because there's a durability issue with either one. Either it's a patient durability related to long-term oral anticoagulation, or it's a durability issue with a tissue valve that has a limited lifespan, particularly the valves used today. If you look at the emerging therapies like what we're doing, of course, we have the MitraClip repair technology that's now been approved and is being used pretty broadly all over, and that's already a $500 million a year market and growing. The main reason is because there's not really a choice. You have all of these interventional percutaneous or transseptal mitral valve replacement technologies like what we have that are going to be the next phase of treating mitral regurgitation. We think that's where the real market opportunity is, because that's what physicians tell us they want to do. They want to replace the valve. They want to have a more reliable, permanent solution to mitral regurgitation. The only thing that's been in the way is how do we get that done? That's where we come in. Let me tell you a little bit about the LivaNova system and what we have. I mentioned delivery. Delivery of this is a real important part of it. If you look at the mitral valve replacement systems that are transcatheter today that are being evaluated, there's transseptal or transfemoral, some people will call it, and there's transapical. Transapical is when you make a small hole in the chest, then you make a hole in the ventricle, and you put a catheter through that. It's more of a direct shot to the mitral valve. It's easier to do technically. It's much less complicated. You're taking a patient who's already very sick and has a very sick ventricle, and you're just making that ventricle more sick. Not probably the optimal way to do it. The other way is to do it transfemorally, where you go in through the groin into the venous system. You go up a long tube into the heart. You go into the right atrium. You cross over the septum into the left atrium, and then you go right down into the mitral valve. A little more complicated. Takes a little more engineering and skill from the physician to do that. If you look at the progression that happened in TAVR, it's the same thing. It started out transapical, but it migrated to transfemoral because patients do better when you do it that way. The other part of our delivery system that's important is that we have designed this system from day one to be fully transseptal, fully retrievable, fully repositionable, all those kind of things, because that's what the physicians require. They need to be able to adjust course in the middle of a procedure because these patients are sick. Not everything always works exactly the way you think it's going to. We've done that from day one. We're not trying to convert anything from transapical to transseptal. We designed it to do this. The anchor, which is what goes in first, and I'm going to show you a cartoon in a few minutes so you can see how it all works. The anchor is a self-expanding nitinol frame. It's covered in Dacron and PTFE. How that works is the anchor basically goes down. It has four feet on the anchor, and the anchor goes through the mitral valve. There's the mitral valve annulus, where the valve is. The anchor goes through that and then is pulled back up so that those four feet anchor themselves in the gutter or subannular gutter that's right underneath the annulus. That's how you get a real stable position of this valve, which is important to the physician because this thing's going to be forever. That's a key part of this anchor design. The other part is that we've integrated what's called a SAM management feature. SAM stands for, it stands for anterior motion, and it's the thing that happens. I'm just going to try to explain this. The native valve has an anterior leaflet, which if you just don't do anything to it when you replace the valve, it's just going to flutter right in the way of the blood flow out of the ventricle. And physicians are very cautious about that because that's going to create a problem. This SAM management feature, actually, when you deploy the anchor at the end, when you deploy the valve and the anchor together, it captures that leaflet and holds it out of the way. So it's a proprietary differentiated feature we have that makes this valve operate better. The other thing that helps this valve stay out of that outflow tract for blood, which is really key, is that we position the valve a bit supra-annular. So we don't stuff it down into the ventricle like a lot of the, that's a typical way a valve gets put in. It's down further in. We're kind of above that, and we have a nice balance of where it's positioned. And that, again, really makes the physician feel good about the blood flow out of the heart, and that's what they're trying to protect. Now, the valve itself that goes into the anchor is a porcine valve. It's made out of porcine pericardial tissue, so it's not an uncommon tissue. Physicians are used to it. But what we've done that's very unique and proprietary is we call it a circle and a D. So we've taken the natural anatomic shape of the mitral valve, which is a D shape, and we create a frame that matches that so that it fits very well. But the valve itself is a circle, and what the circle allows us to do is create three identical leaflets that all work exactly together like they should. And that does two things for us. It creates a really nice hemodynamic effect. The valve has great blood flow through it, as evidenced by the fact that we have a 3 cm² effective orifice area, which any physician will tell you is better than any surgical valve out there. In addition, it really helps with durability because now you've got all three leaflets working exactly in concert. There's no imbalance between the leaflets. And we've tested our, in the accelerated valve testers, which everybody has to use for FDA and regulatory purposes, we've tested this valve out past 1 billion cycles. So we know it works, and we know it's durable. And so that combination is what makes up our system. And now what I'll do is show you how it actually works. So what will happen is the catheter is going to go up, as I mentioned, through the femoral vein, up into the right atrium, and then across. You can see here it goes across the septum. Once the catheter is across, the anchor is delivered through it with an anchor delivery catheter. That catheter gets retrieved, and then we expand the anchor in the atrium. Now what we do is this is vectored down through the mitral valve. And this is where a lot of the engineering in our delivery system comes in because this vectoring doesn't happen by itself. It's very precise, and our catheter makes it enables the ability to do that. Once it's down into that subvalvular apparatus, it gets pulled back up, as I mentioned, and those feet that you can see, those go into that gutter right here. And now that's what's going to anchor it. So during the procedure, it's very important that we are able to verify that those feet are all in the right place, and that's where special imaging comes into place. Once that happens, the anchor delivery catheter is withdrawn, and now the valve delivery catheter comes down, separate catheter, and the valve will come down, and we will then unsheath the valve and expand it. The valve is covered with a porcine sealing cuff, and that's what allows it to grow in together. It heals well, it has long-term fixation, and it prevents paravalvular leak. Now you see this is that SAM feature I mentioned being deployed, and it's grabbing that leaflet and holding it out of the way. And basically, once that's done, the valve is deployed. Now the echocardiographer, the cardiologist, they're going to verify all the positioning, blood flow, make sure everything's where they want it, that it's working well, and then the system will be removed. And if only it took this long to complete the procedure. 2 minutes, we're done. We just did a case yesterday afternoon here in New York in our PRELUDE trial, which I'll tell you about, and that case took about 2 hours to do. So it's still not a short procedure. It takes a while. A lot of that is imaging, and a lot of it is positioning, and these physicians have to be very careful in how they do it. That'll, of course, get shorter over time, much like TAVR did. TAVR was the same way when it first started. The procedures took a long time. Now they take, you know, an hour. So we'll get there as we refine things. But I'm happy to say that patient is already out of the CCU and in a normal room, and they're sitting upright and doing well, so all good. This is a typical patient that we're treating with this system so far. Elderly female is the common denominator here. Usually a lot of comorbidities. So as you can see, most of them have severe mitral regurgitation, grade three or four. Well, all of them do. Most of them have some other form of heart disease, either coronary artery disease, some previous heart procedure. They're all in New York Heart Association class three or four. Pulmonary dysfunction, kidney disease in half the patients. It's very common. So these are not healthy patients coming in and being treated. And, you know, that's one of the challenges with this whole patient population is particularly when you compare it to the TAVR population. It's a much sicker group of people. But what you hear from the patients is they're amazed at how much better they feel after this procedure because, as I mentioned, their quality of life is not good. It's not uncommon to have one of these patients go through a treadmill test and only be able to walk 2 minutes and they're done. I mean, it's really a lousy situation. And then the physicians will tell you when after they see this in a patient, they can't wait till it's available to everyone. So you get a lot of positive feedback after these procedures. Now, of course, the opportunity here that I'm talking about has drawn a lot of interest from all the big strategics, a lot of M&A activity, a lot of money being invested. So we're not alone in this space. There's probably 80 therapies between mitral valve replacement and mitral valve repair chasing this opportunity. Like any technology, though, a handful will be there at the end of the day. We'll be one of those. So what are the investments it's going to require to build this market, take the technology forward? I think it really comes down to two main areas. One is clinical evidence. That kind of trumps everything else. If you don't have good clinical evidence, you're probably not going to make it. So we're investing and are planning to continue to invest in a robust clinical science strategy. And, you know, just like everybody, that starts with you got to prove efficacy. You got to even show right now, like we are, that it's even feasible to do this. That helps you learn who are the right patients to treat. It helps you learn how to refine the technique, how to refine the product. Gives you a chance to train the physicians and get the heart teams used to doing this. And then as it migrates forward, of course, you start to expand indications and you start to get reimbursement with that data and include some health economics things, just like everybody. So that's a big part of our investment for the future. The other is product development. You heard Damien talk this morning about a cadence. It's nowhere is it more important than with interventional cardiology because these, as a subspecialty of physicians, they've grown up on rapid product cadence, and they always want the latest gadget. They always want the latest iteration. And if you don't have speed in your product development process, you die. That's basically how this works. So what we need to do is that the requirement then is you have to be very close to your physicians, which we are, because fortunately, this procedure requires you to be part of that team and help teach them, help support them. And we are building a first-class therapy development team in the field that will be better than everybody else's. I can tell already, and I've done this a long time. These guys are good, and that's going to differentiate us from the competition. But what that allows you to do is it allows you to really establish a close collaboration with the physicians, which is required, so that they feel like they're part of the product development and product improvement system. The bigger the company gets, the less that happens, I can tell you. And what happens is you start doing business to physicians, not with them. We're going to do business with physicians. They know that if they come to us and they say, you know what, I noticed this in this procedure, I noticed this, maybe if this was different or if this was a French size smaller, whatever, we'll be back to them in 2 weeks and showing them prototypes. Is this what you mean? Is this what you need? The bigger companies, the way they approach that is they come and they say, hey, here's our latest product. What do you think? Decision-making's over. They're already done developing it. Physician has no part of that process. So we're going to make sure that our cadence of product development is driven by the physician, not driven by somebody who's not treating these patients every day. So this slide here, if there's one message to take away from it, it's patience. This is a long process. Just like any new technology, new therapy that has a significant clinical study component to it. But the market opportunity is worth it. And so it's worth being patient for this because this is a very sustainable long-term growth driver for LivaNova. And I think of it as a gift that keeps on giving because it's going to be here for a long time. We're adding 500,000 patients a year to this pool just in the U.S. and Europe. So it's a great opportunity, but we've got to do it right. The way we talk about it in the caisson building is preservation of therapy. So every decision we make, if it comes down to moving faster on enrollment or moving faster on trying a product out, the first thing we do is it going to compromise the preservation of this therapy? If it is, we'll slow down and we'll do it right. I'm much more concerned about getting this right than I am about getting it done first or fast, because this is going to be here a long time. These patients aren't going anywhere. And what will matter at the end of the day is who's got the best mousetrap, and we're going to have that. So what will happen is we'll get through our studies, as I mentioned. We'll do feasibility. We'll do CE mark. We'll do U.S. pivotal trial. We'll do reimbursement studies. There will be a whole host of post-market studies, things like that. And then as we move forward through the whole market adoption process, after we get access, you know, we'll look at expanding indications, building KOL networks, trying to make sure that the experience that every physician is having is a positive one, so that when they get up on the podium or when they're doing grand rounds or when they're just having a cup of coffee with the cardiologist who refers patients to them, that they can talk about, hey, I'm having this experience with the LivaNova system. Send me all your patients with, you know, mitral regurg. I'll take care of them. They don't have to be operated on. That's where we'll get to. And by then, this is going to be, we'll all be high-fiving each other. So here's the clinical study plan right now. We have three studies on the books today. I mentioned there'll be a lot more. Prelude is the one we're doing as we speak. The patient we enrolled last night is a Prelude patient. That's just an early feasibility study in the U.S. So this is our first in-human experience. We learn as much or more every time we do a case as the physician does. We're learning about, geez, maybe we need to change this in the technique or the procedure. Maybe we need to tweak this in the product. So we're learning. We're not ready for prime time yet, so to speak. That's a 20-patient study. We've enrolled 13 patients. We've implanted 10. We hope to have that all enrolled and done by the middle of 2018. Then we'll move directly into Interlude. We've actually already enrolled our first patient in Interlude, which is in Montreal. But that's a 75-patient study targeted at the CE mark, and that'll probably be 15 centers. And our plan is right now is we think we'll have CE mark by the end of 2019. And then, of course, the bigger one will be the U.S. pivotal study, which will be a randomized study. Now, we don't have all the details of that study worked out yet with FDA, but we're in conversation with them about it. But we know it'll probably be in the neighborhood of 400 patients. We'll probably have 20 to 30 sites, that kind of thing. And we'll be finalizing that protocol over the coming months with FDA. And by the way, FDA has been fantastic to work with. It's like they have had a personality transplant. I can't tell you. I mean, I just haven't seen this in 35 years where all of a sudden they bend over backwards to help us do this stuff. It's really great for whatever that's worth for all your other companies. So we need to make sure the physicians are competent at doing this procedure, and we need to make sure that they're confident in doing it so that they're not shying away from treating patients with it. So what that means is we have to help make sure that we're picking the right patients. Early on, what we're doing right now is all of our investigators, when they identify a patient that they think might be a candidate, they send us their CT scan. We go over that CT scan with them from start to finish. We look at all of the potential risks, all of the challenges anatomically, whatever might come into play, and we decide as a team, customer or company, should we treat this patient or shouldn't we? And that's how we're deciding. Then what we'll do is we'll take that patient's CT scan, if we think they're a good one, and we'll make a 3D printed plastic model of that. and we will let the physician practice on that model so they can get a feel for what's this going to be like in surgery. It's not an exact replica of what it'll be like because, you know, when the patient's heart is beating and they're alive and all that, it's different than on a plastic model. But from the standpoint of delivering it, vectoring it, they can at least have an idea, okay, this is what it's going to be like when I do this. Then what we do is we go in the day before, and our team that I was talking about, our therapy development team, will do on-site training, didactic, hands-on, plastic model, working with the angiographer and the echocardiographer. Every aspect of the procedure will get worked out. Then the day of, we're there side by side with the physician, helping them through every step of the case, making sure that they get comfortable with the system, comfortable with everything that's going on, and we're there to help them. Then even after the case is done, we'll have a debrief with the heart team. Okay, was there any part that didn't go as you guys wanted? Is there anything we could do better? Is there anything we could do differently? That's how we're going to try to create that level of confidence and preserve the therapy. I talked about the competitive landscape. The key thing to take away from this slide is that as you get into the transseptal group, it starts to get a lot smaller because it's harder. Right now there's us, and as I mentioned, we designed it that way from the beginning. There's Edwards, who's converting their CardiAQ technology from transapical to transseptal. Abbott has a product, and Edwards has another. Neither of those second two are really the lead for them for this. And then there's a whole bunch of transapical because it's easier. Now, there's probably been 150 cases done to date, somewhere in that ballpark, of TMVR. Probably 25 of them have been transseptal, like ours. The other 125 have been transapical. So everybody that's in transseptal is still pretty early, like us. So in summary, technology, I think if you think back to what we've talked about that differentiate our system, I think we have the best technology. And I'm not, I mean, everybody's going to say that, right? I'm not just saying that. I look at the other technologies, and they're not bad technologies, but they're basically taking TAVR-type designs and thinking and trying to just adapt it to mitral. We've taken ours and tried to target mitral from the very beginning, and everything about our system is targeted at the mitral valve apparatus. So I think we have some real competitive advantages that will enable us to be the leader in this market. Clinical evidence will speak for itself. It just stands to reason that if we have the best product, we should get the best clinical results, particularly because we're also providing the best clinical support to the hospital. And then the physician focus, as I mentioned. You know, we have kind of a DNA of collaboration within our building. We've all worked for companies where you work hand-in-hand with physicians 24/7, and you talk to them every day, and you know, you have very productive discussions about what's working, what isn't working, what do we need to do different, what can you do different, et cetera. And what that will amount to over time is what we need to develop this market, which is physician advocacy. We will create a number of physician advocates who not only are going to be helping expand the TMVR market, but they're going to be helping us gain market share because we have the best system. And this is one area where I think having so many competitors, and particularly big competitors, is helping us. Because one of the things you get when you have the big guys all in a new space like this is they're all investing a lot of money in market development, reimbursement, awareness, all those things. So we all draft off of each other in that regard. So I don't mind having the big players in this space. It's going to help us. It's a level of cooperation. It's when it gets down to market share, that's where we're going to win the game. They'll help us build the market. We'll take the market share. So anyway, that's all I have. And I really, again, appreciate you listening, especially after lunch. I know it's not easy. And I hope I didn't put anybody, I don't see any faces down. And then what I'd like to do is maybe have Karen and Damien come back up, and we could answer some questions, or at least try to answer some questions.
Yeah, so we've got about 30 minutes left. So we're going to do about 10 minutes on TMVR. Then we're going to have the other three presenters come up, and we've got about 20 more minutes to finish up.
Where are you going to sit?
Where do you want me to sit?
Deanna over here. Got one in the back.
I'll sit right next to
you. Oh, we've got one in the back. Sorry. We'll go next. Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Rick Wise, Stifel.
Oh, where is he?
Two two questions. One, Paul, could you talk a little bit about the patent portfolio? I mean, it seems like really an elegant solution, you know, the valve-in-valve sort of valve-in structure. And maybe reflect a little bit on what's the most proprietary and best protected? Is it the vectoring delivery, feet in the gutter, the design itself? Maybe talk about that. And I'll just ask my second question now. Just talk a little bit more about the 13 patients enrolled and implanted. What happened to the three patients that didn't implant? Was it valve failure? Was it inappropriate? You know,
sure.
What did you learn? How do we think about that? And
sure.
How does the FDA react to all that?
Sure. Well, I'll start the IP question. You know, I can't speak a lot about it or don't want to speak a lot about it, but what I'll tell you is we have a number of issued patents. I think we have 9 or 10 issued patents. But we've covered and filed on all of our proprietary aspects of the delivery system, the valve, the anchor, a couple of method, you know, parts of it. So we have a very comprehensive coverage of it, and those, you know, we'll continue to file, we'll continue to get patents issued. So I feel very good about how differentiated it is and how well protected it is. And fortunately, you know, it's not like we've been doing this for 20 years, so it's not like we're going to get to market and they expire the next day, like some of the TAVR ones kind of did. We'll have coverage for quite some time, and so I'm not too worried about that either. Now, as far as the second question, you know, I mentioned we've enrolled 13 patients. We've implanted 10. So three patients ended up being converted. Two were converted to surgical valve replacement. One was converted to a MitraClip. Those happen for various reasons. It's not because our product failed or because the valve failed or anything like that. What usually will happen is the physician will get in there, and if for one reason or another they're not comfortable that either they're going to be able to seat the valve properly or they don't like the way it looks, which is why we make it fully retrievable, then it gives them the option to do something different because they can take it out. And that's what happened in those three. Sometimes it's because the patient all of a sudden gets really sick. Something happens and, you know, maybe their pressures drop or who knows what. You know, like I said, they're sick patients. Something can happen. And the physician just feels more comfortable, particularly early on in the investigation when it's maybe their first case. They're pretty quick on the gun to pull if they're not comfortable because they don't want anything really bad to happen. So that's what's happened. FDA has been fantastic. You know, they have us debrief with them every case. Like, what'd you learn? And they've even asked us, don't do two cases in a row, like 2 days in a row. Take a breath, talk to us. They really want to know how we're doing. Is there anything we should be concerned about? Can we help you with anything? And like I said, they've been terrific. In fact, one of the things they did for us is we were treating some patients that were really sick, and FDA said, you know, maybe it would be good for you guys to have a compassionate use arm even in your feasibility study so that you can still treat those patients and help them, but not necessarily have to enroll them. I've never seen FDA proactively do that. So we did. We went back. We've revised our protocol. We've created that arm. We haven't used it yet, but we have the ability to, and that was all facilitated by FDA.
Thanks, Karen. Jason Mills, Canaccord Genuity. Thanks, Paul, for that. Exciting times in transcatheter mitral. So I literally have, you know, probably a dozen questions. I'll try to limit it to two areas, first being patient selection, and you spoke to that. I think, you know, it's noble that you've addressed that is a key thing. Investors have been asking about patient selection for a while. So I wanted you to start there and try to help us understand the patient selection criteria discussions that you're having with the FDA as you look forward to broader pivotal trials. And then within that is sort of a second question within patient selection. As I understand talking to physicians in surgical mitral valve replacement and repair, the goal has been over 30 years MR of zero, which is very hard to do, and surgeons don't let off that. And so is MR of zero really going to be the target here for transcatheter mitral valve replacement? And if not, should we be, will you be thinking about, will the FDA be thinking about quality of life metrics, weighting them more than we have in maybe TAVR? Second part of that question is imaging.
The Scott Bardo-like question.
Yeah, this is multi-part. So on the imaging side, I guess just the most simplistic way to ask this question is, based on your study of the mitral market over the years and where you are now with transcatheter mitral, is the innovation on the device implant side at a further along period or pace than the imaging of the valve, or vice versa? Do you have the imaging necessary today to be able to image the valve to do the procedure if the technology was locked and ready?
Just because I have a good memory, it's just short, so I'll go backwards. it's the imaging part, we can do the procedure today with the imaging available. But the imaging is getting better, and it's going to really help a lot. So one of the things we're trying to do is work with some centers who have access to imaging from some of the imaging companies that's not yet on the market, but that's the next phase. And what we're going to learn early, how do we take advantage of that imaging? And I think what we're going to find is that it's going to considerably simplify the procedure, because it's all about imaging. If, you know, it's really hard for the physician if they can't, if they're not naturally inclined to think three-dimensionally, because they're used to using fluoroscopy, which is two-dimensional, and they're not just naturally good at it, then it can be a very challenging procedure. But some of the new imaging is going to combine fluoroscopy and echocardiography into one, and you're going to be able to do things you can't do today. And I think it's going to actually really reduce the difficulty of the procedure and hence the procedure time, because a lot of time gets spent on imaging. So that's that one. You asked about the patient criteria, selection criteria. I don't necessarily want to go into it in a lot of detail, but what we're trying to do early on is we're looking at all the factors. You know, we're looking at anatomy, we're looking at ejection fraction, and all of the kind of hemodynamic comorbidity issues to just try to make sure that we're risk profiling these patients and not getting a patient that has too many black checks against them, where you go in basically setting yourself up for failure. We don't want to do that. On the other hand, these are sick people. You can't screen them all out. So, you know, we are treating sick patients, as you can see by that profile. You know, class 3, class 4 heart failure, a lot of comorbidities, you know, ejection fractions of probably as low as 30%, maybe 25 sometimes. So they're not healthy people. But we're not trying to do anything crazy. So and we're learning that. That's part of what this feasibility study is for, is to learn who are the patients we should and shouldn't be treating.
MR0.
Oh, MR0.
Yeah.
That is the goal. It's always the goal. We have a much better chance of achieving that goal than repair does. And I think the way we've designed our valve, we have a competitive advantage. The sealing cuff really helps with paravalvular leak. The fact that we have this D-shaped ring and an anatomical fit, I think we've created a lot of advantages for our technology to achieve MR0. Now, we won't achieve it all the time, but we're already in the 10 implants we've done. We're already seeing a lot of MR0 or very just trace MR. So it's, so far, it's, that's what they like. And that's why physicians want to do replacement instead of repair.
And just a quick follow-up, and I'll hand the microphone back. On patient selection specifically,
mm-hmm.
With the 13 that you've identified so far, what are the core common denominators that you've looked for to allow those procedures to go forward? And then on both sides, both, you know, sort of as inclusion, like, okay, we're looking for these things to include these, and then we're also looking for things
mm-hmm.
that would exclude patients
yeah.
definitively, at least initially as you're going through the EFS. Thank you.
Probably the two biggest ones right now, and I'm not sure I'm certainly not the expert on this, but one is valve size. Because, you know, patients have different size valves, and right now we have one size valve. So we do exclude patients who have larger valves that are maybe not where our valve maybe just isn't big enough yet. And we're addressing that. We're developing two new larger size valves, and that'll help us address a larger population of the patients. So we will exclude for that. And we try to make sure that any patient we are going to include that we feel comfortable our valve is the right size. If a patient has an ejection fraction that's too low, they'll get booted out because the physicians don't want to treat anybody, for the most part, with an ejection fraction less than 30. A few people will go down to 25, but below that, they just don't want to. They don't want to take the risk. It's things like that. A lot of those other hemodynamic factors. If there's just too many things stacking up that make it look like they might not be able to make it without something bad happening, then we'll not do them. But you know, the physicians want to treat these patients because they are so sick and have such a poor quality of life. So they bend over backwards to try to figure out a way to treat them.